Turn to Romans chapter 1. We'll be finishing this chapter. Romans 1, 28 through 32. Once I graduated college, a lot of my peers and classmates were going off to seminary. And at the time, I wanted to go to seminary, desired seminary education, but wasn't, for certain circumstances, able to go. Lord's providence, I was able to go about 5 years later. But there was a little bit of envy in me that my friends were going. They were going off to these great institutions. And I wasn't able to go. But James chapter 3 and James chapter 1, both of those chapters meant a lot to me during that time. Because James chapter 1 gave me this promise, ye who lack wisdom. And I said, well, that's me. I fit in that category. Let them ask God. And it goes on to say how that God will give generously or liberally without finding fault, or he abradeth not, according to the King James. And I found that very comforting. I was like, okay, I'm not able to go and further my education, but I want wisdom. I want to be taught. And here's this promise given to me, that if I pray for wisdom, if I acknowledge I need wisdom, I lack wisdom, I would pray for wisdom, that God would answer that. That was one of those guarantees. This is an easy thing. So all I do is pray. All I have to do is ask. And I begin to pray that prayer every day without fail. Every day. Lord, give me this wisdom. Give me this wisdom that you said you would give those who ask. And then in chapter 3, it was very important to me because in chapter 3, it talks about the wisdom as from above. The wisdom that comes from, this is the wisdom that's a gift of God. This is the wisdom you don't get at seminary. You don't get through higher education. This is a wisdom that comes from heaven. It's from above. And there is a contrast, that wisdom which is from below, that comes from this world. And the wisdom that's from this world is very haughty and proudful and arrogant. And those who are taught of this world are just, all they have is the wisdom of this world. It's hard to approach those people. But it says those who have the wisdom from above, first they're going to be pure and they're going to be peaceful and they're going to be easily entreated. It explains the difference in conduct between those who have learned from Christ from those who have just learned from this world. With that said, how much do you seek wisdom from above? How much are you looking to God in your everyday life? How much is God on your mind? How much do you contemplate the Lord when you make decisions? When you're living life, are you living life in communion and fellowship with God? Is God with you? Is he next to you? Is your life a life that's full of prayer? You know, when the Bible teaches us to pray without ceasing, that doesn't mean we stay on our knees all morning and all night and not go to work. It means as we go to work, we're constantly in communion with the Father. As we're interacting with other people, we're God conscious. God is on our mind. We're taking God with us. And we're having a unbroken, the goal is to have an unbroken fellowship, relationship with deity. And that's the essence of godliness, is it not? Godliness is living life in the presence of God. Godliness is welcoming God into your life and into your thoughts, into your brain, where God is always welcome into your thoughts. It's hard to sin, or harder to sin, when your mind is on the Lord. It's easier to fall into temptation when you have kicked God out of your thoughts. Practical atheism is living life without God. I don't believe in theoretical atheist. All people believe in God. But there are some who deny God's existence. But most people, even though they don't claim to be atheists, they live as atheists. They live their lives irrespective of God. It doesn't matter if God's there or not. They're making their decisions on their own, doing it their own way, living life according to their own plans. The Bible tells us that we're in all thy ways acknowledge Him, and He will direct your paths. And every decision you make, we need to make it by acknowledging God, looking to God, keeping God on the forefront of your thoughts. But it contrasts that with the wicked. It says, for the wicked, God is in none of their thoughts. Psalms 10, verse 4 says. The wicked do not only acknowledge God, they don't want God's counsel or His direction. They don't want His advice. They're not studying the Scriptures to see what God has to say about this or that. They don't care. So here's the question as we go through this text. How much do you care about God's counsel? How much do you think about the Lord? How much is He in your thoughts? This text, starting at verse 28 to 32, explains to us the cost of kicking God out of our thoughts. What is going to cost you if you don't think about God? Let's begin with verse 28. And since then, they did not see fit to acknowledge God. God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. They were filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Though they know God's righteous decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but give approval to those who practice them. In this, we see the cost of kicking God out of your thoughts. The cost of a secular mind. There's three things it's going to cost you. You will lose God. Two, you will lose godliness, or you will gain ungodliness. And three, you'll become a detriment to yourself and a detriment to others. First of all, the cost we see in verse 28 of not thinking about God is that you lose God. Verse 28 tells us, if we abandon God, God will abandon us. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God or think about God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. This verse is a play on words. It's contrasting the two phrases, they did not see fit to acknowledge God. It's contrasting that phrase with the next phrase, God gave them up to a debased mind. In the original language, the words acknowledge and the word debase sound very similar. And no doubt the apostle picked these words because of the words sounding very similar, but they're contrasting words. We'll see in a minute. One is rejecting without consideration. The other one is rejecting with consideration. contrasting words. But it's saying this, if you reject God from your thinking, he's going to reject your thinking altogether. You'll become debased in your thinking. First of all, they did not see fit to acknowledge God. The word acknowledge here means to approve, to allow, or to discern. Literally, it means to examine or to attest. They did not examine God. They did not test God. They did not approve of God because they didn't even examine God. The idea is that they did not even see fit to examine God. They rejected him without any consideration. They discarded God from their thinking, even without considering the value of God. When I was younger, I wanted to be a graphic designer. I wanted to design tennis shoes for Nike. When I was a little kid, I'd draw these mock-up shoes. The first ones weren't very good, but I thought I got pretty talented at making these shoe designs. And I'd spend hours coming up with these great designs. And I began to send them to Nike. You know, I looked up their address and put them in envelopes, wrote a little letter and said, here's my design, feel free to use it. And I would get these, you know, 6 weeks later, I get these envelopes back. And I'm just 8 or 9, 10 years old. 18, 19, I don't know. I would get these letters back, returned to sender. They didn't even open the envelope. I mean, rejection without consideration. Just turning me down flat. Nope. Nope, we're not even going to look at them. That's what's going on here. Rejecting God. Pushing God out of the thoughts without consideration. Without even acknowledging him. Without even contemplating him. Just a total rejection. This is why the NIV translates this. They did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God. Jonathan Edwards says, it is evident that the mind of man is naturally averse to the thinking about God. And hence, if any thoughts of him be suggested to the mind, they soon go away. Such thoughts are not apt to rest in the minds of natural man. Man simply doesn't want to think about God. They'd rather not think about God. They'll think about everything under the sun. You ever notice that about getting into a conversation with people? You can talk up about almost everything under the sun. You turn it to the Lord and things go silent. This is because people don't want to talk about God. Think about God. As I've said in Psalms 10:4, God is not in all their thoughts. And because man will not think about God, here's the consequence. Therefore, or as the verse 28 says, since they did not acknowledge God in their thinking, they did not see fit to acknowledge God. Since, it says, God gave them up to a debased mind. See, this is divine judgment. It's only after man would not consider, contemplate, examine God that God, in judgment and in wrath, gave them up to a debased mind. This word debased means failing to pass the test or being unapproved. This is God examining man and looking at man. And after an examination, then discarding and rejecting. This is Nike opening up the packages, looking at them, giving them a good examination, and comparing them. And after seeing that they're not fit to be used, then discarding them. See, man will discard God without contemplation or examination. But God only rejects man after he contemplates and sees that they're unfit. So thus, this word is to be rejected. In fact, many times this word is translated reprobate. It's to give over or to pass up, but only after seeing they are unfit or worthless. They think God is unworthy to examine. God thinks they are unworthy after examination. Thus, a reprobate mind is not the consequence of just man falling into sin. This is the consequence of man rejecting God in his thinking. Now, in our text, in the structure of this, going back to what we preached last week, this is not saying the consequence of homosexuality, which we looked at last week, is a debased mind. This is going back to the beginning. In verse 12, at the beginning, that they knew there was a God, but they suppressed the knowledge of God in unrighteousness. And see, we talked about how homosexuality was God abandoning you, leaving you to yourself. If you make a graven image of God and you defame and debase his image, he will turn and debase your image. So homosexuality is a sin against the body. Now this is a sin against the mind. First, God's going to give you over, your body's over, that you disgrace your bodies with others. Here, this is a sin of the mind, of the thoughts. And this is happening all around us. So this is where people will refuse to think about God, and therefore God will judge their thinking. God will judge their minds. The consequences of not thinking about God is God not thinking about you. Is God giving you over? Is God rejecting you? It's God forsaking you. If you forsake God, if you abandon God, don't be surprised if God doesn't abandon and forsake you. This is the danger of not thinking about God. And think about your lives. You think there's no consequences of going all day without praying? You think that you can skip your devotional life and think that that's okay, that you can just live life with little to no consideration of God and it's not going to affect your homes, your families, and your marriages? It does. God gives people over to a mind that becomes dysfunctional, foolish, and depraved. This is not God giving you over where you lose a couple points of your IQ. It's not you becoming less intellectual. It's not a loss of intelligence when God gives you over to a debased mind. Stephen Hawking may be, for example, the smartest person alive. Maybe. They consider him to be on par with Einstein. But he's a great fool, according to the Bible. He's smart. He's intelligent. Full of knowledge. So this is being given over to a debased mind doesn't mean you cease to lose your reasoning skills. A debased mind and a godly mind has little to do with our intelligence, but has a lot to do with our wisdom and godliness. How we live life. You know, I've thought about this a lot. Would I rather lose my body or my mind? And I'm sure we've all thought about that as we get older. You know, I would hate to lose the function of my body, to be bedridden but thinking clearly. You know, I'm thinking sharply and my mind's intact, but my body's just not responding to my commands. That would be a difficult, very difficult thing to endure. But what if you had a very good body that can do almost anything, but your mind's gone? You have a stroke or something and your thinking is just not where it used to be. Or if you just go, kind of crazy. I used to go to the nursing home and minister people, and I noticed the people with dementia and Alzheimer's seemed to be the happiest people. You know, it seems like God compensates for that by giving them a sense of joy, happy. And a lot of times people who have a solid, sound mind, but their body is not working, they're grouchy and miserable and unhappy. Einstein's therapist said that he's determined that the higher the intellect, the more depressed they are. I can see y'all a very happy group here. But you know what's worse than losing your mind? I mean, you can lose your mind, become more and more forgetful, come down with Alzheimer's, come down with dementia. That happens to Christians all the time. But you can still be a godly person. Godly person as you lose your mind. What I don't want to lose. Take my memory away, that would be tragic. Take my body away, it would be tragic. But, oh Lord, don't forsake my thinking. Don't leave me to myself. Don't depart from my thoughts. A God-forsaken mind is the worst of all. Because not only are you in trouble in this life, in the next life as well. You see, the consequence of not thinking about God is a mind that has been forsaken by God. David, King David, is counseling his son Solomon in 1 Chronicles 28:9. He says, "And you, Solomon, my son, know the God of your father and serve him with a whole heart and with a willing mind. For the Lord searches all hearts and understands every plan and thought. If you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will cast you off forever." And this promise is for us. If you seek the Lord, you shall find him. If you acknowledge him, he will direct your paths. If you need wisdom, you can ask and he will give it to you. He'll supply it to you. This is God's promise. If you want God's help, if you need God in your life, then he's there. Begin to acknowledge him. Think about him. Dwell on him. Live with him in your mind. But if you forsake God in your thinking, he will forsake your and give you over to a reprobate mind. Proverbs 16:3 says, "Commit your works to the Lord, and he will establish your ways." So whatever you're at in your life, whatever you're going through right now, just acknowledge God. Dwell on God. Seek help from him. See, this is the first consequence of forsaking God in our thoughts, is being given over to a God-forsaken mind. The second cost of forsaking God in our thoughts is that we gain godlessness. Verses 29 through 31. If you empty your mind of God, you're going to have a void. And in that void, ungodliness is going to rush in and take that place. Verse 28 says, "And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. They were filled," that word filled is like curious, that the thinking is filled with all manner of unrighteousness and evil. If there's one thing we learn in the Bible, is that our behavior is connected to our thinking. This is why it's so important that we have sound doctrine and sound theology. A reprobate mind is a mind that has rejected God, but as a mind that has also been rejected by God, which leads to a depraved and evil mind. Notice in verse 29, when God is pushed out of the thinking, evil rushes into the thinking. They were filled with all manner of unrighteousness and evil. Friedrich Nietzsche spoke about the death of God. And this is a brilliant man, or was a brilliant man, before the last 10 years of his life, he went insane. And he claimed that he was God at the end of his life. But prior to going insane, he wrote several books. But one book that he wrote, he proclaimed that God was dead. And what he's saying, I'm about to read this clip from this book. What he's saying is not that God is dead. He's saying that God was never alive, but he was alive at least in our thinking. We used to believe there was a God. There was never a God, but used to believe there was a God. And as long as we believed in God, he said, it determined how we lived. But now, as a society and as a culture, we no longer believe in God. There are some consequences of God not being in our minds. He writes, "Have you not heard of the madman who lit a lantern in the bright morning hours, ran to the marketplace and cried, 'I seek God, I seek God.' As many of those who do not believe in God were standing around, he provoked much laughter. Has he got lost?" one asked. "Did he lose his way as a child?" asked another. "Or is he hidden? Is he afraid of us? Has he gone on a voyage? Is he immigrated?" Thus they yelled and laughed. But the madman jumped into the mist and pierced them with his eyes. "Where is God?" he cried. "I will tell you, we have killed him. You and I, all of us are his murderers. But how did we do this? Whither are we moving away from all suns?" Now here he's about to explain that. Here's the consequences of not having God. Are we not plunging continually backwards, sideways, forward, in all directions? We have no compass now. We have no direction. We have no guidance to how to live life. We're just a free-for-all. Is there any up or down, or right and wrong? Are we not straying as through an infinite nothing? Do we not feel the breath of empty space? Has it not become colder? Is not night continually closing in on us? Do we not need to light lanterns in the morning? Do we not hear nothing as the noise of the grave diggers who are burying God? Do we smell nothing yet of the divine decomposition? God's to decompose. God is dead. God remains dead. And we have killed him. And what Nietzsche does, he's bold. Of all the philosophers who don't believe in God, Nietzsche was the boldest of them all, because he says, yes, there's no God, but we need to embrace the consequences of no God. And because there's no God, we have to invent, he goes on to say, new rules for morality. No longer do we have a sovereign God to tell us how to live and how to behave. We have to come up with our own code of living. And where do we look, Nietzsche says? Nietzsche says we have to look to ourselves. In fact, rather, we need to look at nature. And building off the teachings of Charles Darwin that said the survival of the fittest, that we arrived through the strong overcoming the weak, Nietzsche claimed, therefore, the highest virtue is the strong overcoming the weak. Because Friedrich Nietzsche believed in the Übermann, the German word which means overman, which could be translated Superman. He believes that in time there's going to be a new race of people that would evolve out of this current race of people. And the only way that would happen is if the strong overcomes the weak die out, and the strong end up producing even stronger and more intelligent beings. Nietzsche says, once the sin against God was the greatest sin, but God died, and these sinners died with him. To sin against the earth is now the most dreadful thing, and to esteem the invisible is the most wicked thing. William Durant, the philosophical historian, says about Nietzsche, "If life is the struggle for existence in which the fittest survive, then strength is the ultimate virtue and weakness is the only fault. Good is what survives, which wins. Bad is that which gives away and fails. The ultimate ethic is biological. We must judge things according to the value for life. Nietzsche says, I've often dreamed it must be more blessed to steal than to give. He turns evil upside down and good upside down. He wrote a book, it's called Beyond Good and Evil. And in that book, he says, to abstain from mutual injury, violence, to equate one's will with someone else's, reveals itself as will towards the denial of life, the principle of dissolution and decay. Life itself essentially consists of depossessing, injuring, overpowering the foreign and the more feeble, suppression, imposing one's own forms, annexing, and at least the mildest, exploding. You see what he's saying? He says if there's no God, if we push God out of our thinking, then we have to have something to guide us in our behavior. And what will that be? Charles Darwin says, we civilized men do our utmost to check the process of elimination. We build asylums for the imbecile, the maimed, and the sick. Thus, the weak members of civilized societies propagate their kind. No one who has attended to the breeding of domestic animals will doubt that this must be highly injurious to the race of man. He says, what farmers will breed weak cattle together? No, we don't do that. He says, why are we allowing that to happen with the human race? Charles Darwin says, it is surprising how soon a want of care or caring wrongly directed leads to the degradation of the domestic race. But expecting in the case of man itself, hardly anyone is so ignorant as to allow the worst animals to breed. Sigmund Freud says he bemoaned the reduction of the infant mortality because it says, quoting, works against the beneficial efforts of natural selection. And our country in the 40s and the 30s were involved in eugenics, sterilization of what they considered to be the feeble and the weak. Nietzsche says, you say that a good cause justifies war. I say unto you, is good for war for any cause. Nietzsche goes on to say, what is good? All that enhances the feeling of power, the will of power, the power itself in man. What is bad? All that proceeds from weakness. What is happiness? The feeling that power is increasing, that resistance has been overcome. Not contentment, but more power. Not peace, but war. Not virtue, but efficacy. The weak and the bought shall perish. First principle of our humanity. And they ought to even be helped to perish. This is why Friedrich Nietzsche was Hitler's philosopher. Adolf Hitler says, those who want to live, let them fight. Those who do not want to fight deserve to die. But this is what you get without God. This is what you get. Nietzsche is just bold enough to say it. It turns morality upside down. It's good to be selfish. It's good to be greedy. It's good to be domineering. You see, Christianity values the weak, the sick, and the feeble. You know why? Because every soul, even the unborn child in the womb, or the aging senior citizen that needs to be spoon-fed, every person is valuable because every person is made in the image of God. Amen. You take God out, then man is nothing but an animal. What should determine our behavior is nothing more than the survival of the fittest. You see, this is what happens. Though Nietzsche says it, he's bold in saying it, and by the way, liberal interpreters of Nietzsche will try to downplay all that and say Nietzsche did not promote social Darwinism, but he did. He was bold about it. But you and I have done the same thing. not in our words, but in our practice. But look at this list. It turns good into bad and bad into good. We're filled with all unrighteousness and evil. If you don't think about God, this is what's going to happen. And there's 20 things. In fact, this is the longest list of sins in the Bible. 20 or 21, depending on how you look at it. Starting at verse 29. If we don't think about God, we will be filled with mental sins that torment ourselves. Covetousness, which is an unhappiness that is caused by longing for something that we don't have. Covetousness destroys peace and happiness within. It's self-destructive. Malice or spite, intention to do evil. Goes on to say they are full of envy, jealousy of others for what they've done or what they've been rewarded with. Then there's a list of mental sins that torments not just ourselves but others. Verse 29, it says murder, strife, deceit, which is maliciousness. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, which means disrespectful, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, and foolish. Selfish, 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 selfish underlines all these things. Pride, arrogance, haughty, haters of God and haters of one another, disobedient to parents, slanderers, gossipers. Then this last list is being deprived of all goodness, verse 31. Faithless, which is no reliability. Heartless, no compassion. Ruthless, no pity. This is where it takes you, down the road of Friedrich Nietzsche's philosophy. You become that philosophy. You're not just proclaiming it, you're living it out in your lives with God and not in your life. If you kick God out of your thoughts, what's going to rush into your behavior is this ungodliness. But as I said, if you lack wisdom, let them ask God who gives generously to all without reproach. You know, the wisdom from above is not like this. I love this. This means so much to me personally. James 3:13, who is wise and understanding among you? By his good conduct, let him show his works in meekness. Think of the contrast between this and what we just read. Meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast and be false to the truth. This is not the wisdom that comes from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. Where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder in every vile practice. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial and sincere. Now that is the type of person I want to be. I want to be that person. Gentle, kind, peaceful, humble, meek. And if I want to be that type of person, what do I need? I need God. You want to reform your marriages? You want to shape up your life? You need God in your life. This can only come from above. This is supernatural wisdom. This comes on your knees. But we get busy and distracted. But the last consequences is found in verse 32. And this shows you the wickedness of humanity. We become a detriment to self and to others. You see, society breaks down and self-destructs at this level. If we do not acknowledge God, we will become a detriment to ourselves and to others. We see that in verse 32. Though they know God's righteous decrees that those who practice such things deserve to die. How evil and foolish do you have to be to know that you're going to be punished by God for your behavior, but you just don't care? You've heard the story of my friend who grandpa passed away. He says, you know, when you bury me, throw a carton of cigarettes in there, but don't worry about a lighter because I don't need that where I'm going. And he said it so proudly, boasting. And I think he believed it. He knew he was going to hell. He wasn't denying that. But he didn't care. How hardened do you have to be? How God-forsaken do you have to be? Till you don't care about God's judgment, but you acknowledge that there is a judgment. You see, this is where it takes you. Thoughtlessness of God. Not thinking about God. Suppressing the truth and unrighteousness. Neither being thankful or honoring God. Makes it hard on you. Proverbs 11:15 says, the righteous of the blameless will smooth his ways, but the wicked will fall by his own wickedness. You see, this is the silliness of it all. People's sins is self-destructive. It's harmful. But you're willing to go ahead and do it knowing that it's going to be detrimental to yourself. You're willing to sin. You're willing to forsake God knowing that you're going to be judged by God. But you do it anyway. This is at the bottom of the pit. This is as callous as it becomes. Yet there's one more step of callousness, and this is the last phrase. And I don't know how it could get any worse than this. The last phrase of 32. They not only do them, but give approval to those who practice them. Not only are they a self-detriment and harming themselves and foolish in their own practices. Yeah, I know what I'm doing is not right. I know I'm going to be judged for this, but I don't care. But when you begin to approve and encourage others to go down that same path, how wicked do you have to be? Charles Hodge says, this is the lowest point of degradation. To sin, even in the heat of passion, is evil. But to delight in the sins of others, show that man are set in his purposes to do wickedness. When you actually enjoy other people sinning, one of my favorite skateboarders when I was a kid was a guy named Christian Hosoi. And I read his biography about 2 years ago. And Christian said that his father gave him his first joint at 5 years old. He smoked his first joint at 5 years old, and it was his dad that gave it to him. I mean, I think about some of these drug dealers that will go to high schools and schools to kids and sell them drugs. I mean, how wicked do you have to be in enjoying and delighting the other people's self-destruction? But this is where it becomes. Not only they do it themselves, but they delight and glory in those who do the same. Well, why should we think about God? Let's end on a positive note. Why should we think about God? Well, what's amazing is Psalms 139, verse 17. And this is the psalmist reflecting upon God. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I would count them, they are more than the sand. I awake and I'm still with you. psalmist is not saying, how glorious are my thoughts about you? I think about you all the time. He's not saying that. He says, how precious are your thoughts of me? You think about me so much that I can't count that. Why should you think about God? Well, if you're a child of God and you do not have a reprobate mind, then God thinks about you constantly. And he never does anything directed towards you. Now, he does all things for his own glory, but when he arranges your life, he arranges it all for your good. And he doesn't allow one thing to happen that's not going to work for your good and for your sanctification. God's always contemplating you in the equation. Always. And here, we sometimes won't think about God. May we seek to be godly in our thinking. It begins there. Holiness of living begins in thinking, dwelling, meditating upon the Lord. Let us dwell upon the Lord day and night, and let's acknowledge him in all of our ways. Thus, abandoning God in our thoughts, as we've learned, God will abandon our minds to ungodliness, to self and social destruction. Let's go to the Lord in prayer.